To thank both Videoblocks.com as well as Songfinch for sponsoring this episode. Stick around to learn about some amazing offers available to you for being a listener of Not Alone. We are also brought to you through the unfailing support of our patrons over at Patreon.com. These donations help us to keep the lights on every month and allow us to access the materials we need to bring you the highest caliber of show that we can, which is, of course, what you, our listeners, deserve. Now, to learn more about supporting your favorite show, head over to patreon.com/notalonepodcast. Thank you so much to everyone who helps make this possible week after week. Now, let's get on with the show.
This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
What we're going to cover this week is a subject that we've had people request before, and it's just the perfect example of something that I'd love to talk about, but it doesn't always fit our format. And so
what
we need to do, right, what we do on this show with the except for the Jason specials, they're their own little thing, but what we do is we tell stories, right? We're a narrative-based podcast. Mm-hmm. And so this is more of a subject-based thing, but I wanted to find a story. We found a story. So this week, we're going to talk about voodoo and zombies.
That's up our alley. What are you talking
about? Well, it's up our alley, but I felt like without a specific zombie story, we couldn't do it because there would be no narrativistic quality.
I'm not going to lie. Reading through the notes, first off,
yes.
Very impressed.
Thank you. There's a lot in here.
Unfortunately, did like most of my work for me, which I do appreciate that.
Yeah. You're welcome.
I did my own work too.
Good.
But it does feel a little specially.
Does it?
A little Jason special in here somewhere.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to do it?
Oh, no.
No. Okay.
You've already got it. You know me in reading.
Okay. That's fair. So this week, dear listeners, we are finally going to tackle zombies and voodoo and black magic,
which is super down exciting. South.
It's super exciting. It's super interesting. It's some of the most interesting research I've done yet for this podcast. Yeah. And I either am excited or regretful to tell you, depending on your own worldview, that this is going to be part one of a multi-part series. I know we've been doing that a lot lately. If you like that, let me know. If you don't like that, let me know. But with this, I was working well into the night last night to finish it up, and it just hit me that even if I got it finished, the episode would be like 2.5 hours. And so I figure it's just better if we just split it up. We'll do an hour and a half this week, hour and a half next week, or something like that. It's going to be fine. So, yeah.
Voodoo and zombification.
Voodoo and zombification.
Which, probably for most listeners, the only reference that we have to that is probably pop culture,
right?
In our own media in the States here, which does lead to misconceptions about the actual culture itself, and it's not just all this black magic,
right?
Which we're gonna dive into in just a second here, but we're gonna do a recap of zombies.
Recap
as well.
First. So
tell me about the zombies, Sam.
Yes, this week we're gonna talk about one specific zombie case. It's the zombification. And get ready for a lot of bad pronunciations.
Oh, yeah.
It's the zombification of Clervius Narcisse. That one I'm fairly confident of. But before we get started with tonight's episode, I just want to say really quick, Jason and I both, this is like the first time we've both been on a show in a long time. Usually it's just me. And this hurts Jason's feelings, I guess.
It's because I'm a mean person.
You're not a mean person. You're fine. Anyway, Jason and I were both on this week's episode of Zang This. That's Z-E-N-G This with an exclamation point with our good friend Zanger and Ellie.
It was super fun.
Yeah, and it was a great time. We talked about the movie Troll Hunter, which is a Norwegian freaking epic.
I'm still pretty impressed.
It's an impressive film. Talked about that. Talked a little bit about troll lore. Talked a little bit about X-Men and Jurassic World and Chris Pratt and Jason Momoa.
So what is Zang this?
It's a pop culture
podcast.
There
we go. Thanks, yeah, dude. Yeah, that helps.
So yeah, go check that out. We'll put a link to that in the blog post for this episode. All right. I think Jason hit it on the head. We as a country really we're not in touch with the actual reality and the actual idea of zombies. Right. The zombie is something that we all lost our collective mind over back in 2010, as well as far beyond that. But that was like the latest reincarnation of the zombie phenomena. It's been going on for years and years and years. And every time that this happens and it becomes big in pop culture again, there's some other massive shift, massive differential from the actual truth of the matter. At its core, you know, the zombie is a reanimation of a corpse. That's really all it is. There has been a whole lot of different Hollywood effects added and different pop culture in the minds of the people. Nowadays, we look at the zombie as a very violent creature and as something to be afraid of, and that it's going to hold you down and eat your brains.
Mm-hmm. But there's really like two variations of the zombie. There's the Night of the Living Dead, which is essentially like this slow-moving real corpse, and then you've got like World War Z-style zombies, right?
Fast zombies.
Which scary zombies.
I disagree with. Fast zombies don't fit the actual folklore of zombies at all. I also just disagree with them on multiple different levels.
Well, the design of those is that it's really just a virus taking over a host for the most part, right?
And right. Then
essentially firing on all cylinders for the body.
Right. Well, and that's what the modern zombie is.
Has evolved into,
It's a virus or it's a pathogen or something like that. It's a biological thing. Whereas the actual zombie, the further back we get, it is completely and totally based on magic.
It's a spiritual thing.
Yeah, even with there being like reports of zombie powders and stuff like that we're going to get into, these powders were just an apparatus in the minds of the people for magic itself. It was never pharmacological until America really took it and twisted it. But the love affair... America's love affair with zombies started all the way back in 1932 with the film White Zombie, which was based on the 1929 nonfiction book The Magic Island by William Seabrook. William Seabrook seems like a very interesting person and someone that I want to learn more about. He went to Haiti, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he went and he'd like go spend time in mountains, and then he'd like go and spend time with Aleister Crowley. And I read this freaking thing where he and Crowley spent a week together on, like, Crowley had a ranch or a farm or something, because of course he did.
I imagine, like, bro festivities.
Well, it was.
Super bromance.
It was.
I imagine with that.
But, in addition to that, they only communicated with different inflections of the word wow.
Wow.
Which makes me think of that,
Owen Wilson.
Like those Owen Wilson things where it's wow. It's awesome.
Oh boy.
So,
okay.
And Seabrook as well was like an adventurer. He was an occultist and an adventurer.
I mean, you kind of have to be if we're talking about Haiti in the 20s, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, and he also went to like West Africa and participated in cannibal rites and stuff like that. He was an interesting, spooky,
that's
weird
pretty crazy
dude.
Because,
yeah,
because voodoo does, like, originate from Western Africa,
right?
So it makes some sense that he kind of hopped the lake in order to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if he, I don't know if that was his main goal. He was more of just like, I want to see everything I can see. I don't care if it's necessarily related, but of course it is.
I think you sometimes travel down a rabbit hole for sure,
right? And he physically actually traveled the world down a rabbit hole. And when you're looking at someone who's, you know, a practitioner of the occult and buddy-buddy with Aleister Crowley, they're going to be interested in all types of magic around the world. Haitian voodoo, that's definitely going to catch their interest. Now, it's this account, this white zombie film, based on the Magic Island. It's the first zombie movie in America. He only briefly mentions the zombie in the book. There's just like one little chapter, but this is what he wrote. He says, "The zombie, they say, is a soulless human corpse, still dead, but taken from the grave and endowed by sorcery with a mechanical semblance of life. People who have the power to do this go to a fresh grave, dig up the body before it had time to rot, galvanize it into movement, and then make it a servant or slave, occasionally for the commission of some crime, more often simply as a drudge around the habitation or the farm, setting it dull, heavy tasks, and beating it like a dumb beast if it slackens." Seabrook was told by multiple people on the island that there were these dead men who are working in the sugarcane fields, and he himself came across three of these different zombies. But he came away saying that more likely than anything else, they were simply individuals with severe cognitive disabilities, unable to think for themselves, most likely born that way or the result of an accident. He, of course, didn't believe in the actual reanimation of a corpse after death. But regardless of the skepticism he portrayed in his book, the idea of the zombie stuck and enthralled the public imagination, creating a legend that still, I mean, what the frick? Walking Dead's like on season 8 now, isn't it?
Yeah. I thought they'd all be dead by now.
Right? That's what you would think, but they're not.
Or at least Carl would cut his hair. Either one.
So this comes up, right? This originally does follow the concept of the zombie fairly closely to actual folklore. The movie itself, White Zombie, was about a white sorcerer in Haiti who created these zombies to work for him. He didn't use them in the sugarcane fields. He used them as like bodyguards and henchmen, essentially. But technically, that is still pretty close to the actual idea. Now, in reality, the zombie is much more used for just basic manual labor, like Seward mentions. The traditional name of the sorcerer that controls the zombie is the Bokor. It's worth noting that the belief in zombies comes from voodoo traditions. It is not necessarily like promoted within the voodoo religion. It's not like a normal good thing to do, right? That's what...
Yeah, like most priests and priestesses of voodoo actually don't really like... support it.
Yeah,
it is still like taboo even for that society. Mm-hmm.
It's an immoral act, and that's something that I think we in the States and probably all around the world, we view voodoo as a scary, evil,
yeah,
devil thing.
All and, we see is like the black magic, yeah, aspect of it with dolls and zombification, right? Like that's
which,
all we have.
The zombification is immoral and it's not practiced widely and shouldn't be practiced at all, and the dolls aren't a thing. Like, they're not a thing.
It's a fabrication.
Yeah, it's more of like another aspect of folklore, but one without any real premise. So I didn't know what voodoo was when I started this.
Really?
No, I
did
knew.
Did you think it was like just literally a black magic?
Yeah,
occult.
That's all
system?
I thought it was, and so. I've done a lot of research, and we're going to talk about it here in a little bit, but it's one of the most interesting belief systems and also one of the, like, I just think it's freaking, it's like beautiful, man. It's
pretty
beautiful,
cool.
Man.
Is.
It's awesome. So we're going to talk about that, but I think it's important that we make it known that, like, these are bad things. And, like, the people practicing voodoo still say that zombification is a bad thing. Neglecting another human being, abusing them. And it's actually on the books in the Haitian penal code that if a person zombifies another person, if that individual is buried, no matter what the end result is, it's murder. And it's going to be treated as such. So we're only focusing on one small part of voodoo. You know, we're going to give you a overview of it for sure. But if you are interested in it at all, I highly, highly encourage you to do your own research. We used a few different sources. The main one that we used is a book called The Serpent and the Rainbow, a Harvard scientist's astonishing journey into the secret societies of Haitian voodoo, zombies, and magic by Wade Davis. That's a fantastic resource.
And for once, I actually agree with that.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I actually watched a fairly lengthy interview with Wade. And
oh, yeah. He knows his stuff,
really, man. I really dig him. Also, he looks, for some reason, a lot like Bill Murray to me.
That's fair.
Did you pick up that vibe
That's
at all?
Fair.
Did
yeah.
you see an image
yeah.
of
him?
Yeah,
I got him. I watched a few interviews with him. He's an interesting individual for sure. So do your own research as well. We'll give you the overview here shortly, but, you know, do your own research. Now, for the specific subject of tonight's episode, we're going to be diving deep into one of the most fascinating and interesting stories of zombification of all time, as well as the best documented.
Yeah, this is the most compelling.
Mm-hmm. It's worth stating that before we start, that while we from a distance may look at the claims of wicked sorcerers turning human beings into zombies as superstition and as something illogical, something that could not happen in the real world, the people in these societies believe this. And like Jason said, this is the most compelling account in the world. It's something that is so ingrained in the culture that these people aren't afraid of zombies coming and eating their
brains.
They're
afraid of becoming zombies.
They're afraid of becoming a zombie. It's a social check. It's a counterweight in their society. Kind of like, in theory, the death penalty would be in ours, but
yeah,
it's even a lot
but
worse.
But in voodoo culture, they don't believe in committing anyone to death. So their punishment becomes becoming a zombie. So it's you know, something worse than death.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So keep that in mind. Yeah.
Here we go.
Without further ado, we bring you the story of Clavius Narcisse. We'd like to preface this by apologizing for all of the things we're going to mispronounce. We're sorry.
You didn't take French in high school, Sam.
I did.
Yo, you did.
Just for one semester. I was okay. Just telling this to somebody. I seriously messed up my high school because I did like one semester
of each.
Yeah.
Oh,
it
you
was terrible.
Silly boy.
It was so stupid. I hate myself. All right. So
you should be able to pronounce these.
No, because the first semester of high school or the first year of high school is when I took French. So that was like,
it's been a while.
That was 9 years ago, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a
while.
So
we're good. Now,
we'll do our best.
So I apologize. Now, our story begins in earnest on the 30th of April, 1962, in the Albert Schweitzer Hospital in Deschapelles, Haiti. It is here that we find Clavius Narcisse being examined by the staff of the hospital. Now, he was complaining of fever and of a strange sensation as if bugs were crawling all over his skin, and he was also spitting up blood full of aches and pains.
Oh, that's not good.
No.
That's internal bleeding.
Yeah. The staff checked him in and gave him a room. They worked tirelessly to diagnose and cure the clearly sick man. And as he lay dying, he was attended to by his sister, Angelina. Now, 2 days later, on the 2nd of May, Clavius Narcisse was declared dead, with multiple attending doctors confirming it. Angelina wept as they pulled the sheet over his face and transferred his body into cold storage. The funeral followed 24 hours later, and he was buried at the local cemetery in Lester. And there he lay for time and all eternity. Now, his family,
Boy,
of course...
He.
No, stop it. We're not there yet.
Oh, okay. Whoops.
His family, of course, was upset and mourned Clavius in their own little ways, but they moved forward with their life. Now, little is known of Clavius's family, but they seem to have gotten on in very much the same way they had before, and they continued to do so for 18 years. Then, one day, in 1980... a man walked up to Angelina in the middle of the marketplace and caught her attention. The man introduced himself as her brother Clavius, and although it is claimed she recognized him almost immediately in any case, he used a childhood nickname to identify himself that would not have been known by others outside of their family. Angelina was understandably shocked and wanted answers from her brother, who gave her quite the chilling account. Now, this is one of the more interesting parts of it for me. Is we think about people going into a near-death state and going into a coma, and they're unconscious, right? They don't see anything. They don't hear anything. what Clavius suggests and what he says is that he remembers all of it and that he was conscious for all of it. His eyes were closed, so he didn't see it, but he did remember, like, the doctor saying, time of death, whatever, which mm-hmm. would just be the most terrifying thing I could think of. He remembers the face or the feel of a sheet being placed over his face. He remembers the sound of Angelina weeping. He remembers the sound of his funeral. He remembers being lifted and put into the coffin. He remembers the sound of the coffin being nailed apart or nailed together. He remembers hearing the dirt hit his coffin as they buried him alive. I don't even want to think about how many people were actually buried alive, and we have no idea. I want to say it's probably a very small number, but it's more likely more than a few. Yeah. I mean, we didn't really get that good at diagnosing death until like the last few hundred years. So, and even then, a lot of that is technological. So there's probably a lot of people who died, and they built like coffins for that. They built safety coffins, right? So they built coffins with air tubes and with bells and with glass lids and all of this.
So what happens? You break the glass lid and the soil just caves in on you?
It's a terrible idea. So the shards of glass
gets pressured into you?
Yes, it's a terrible idea, but these people were understandably upset and scared.
The bell is true. The bell is the best way.
Well,
but like when you think about it, who's gonna hear you still 6 feet under?
There's even
and it's gonna be so hard to actually find you.
I don't remember where it was. It may have actually been in New Orleans once. We went to some cemeteries there.
Oh no, you heard a bell in the cemetery?
No, I didn't hear a bell in the cemetery. Thank goodness. That would be too much.
That would be.
I would just lay down and die.
I know, okay, Frank. I'm gonna pull.
We went to a hospital. Or not a hospital. We went to cemeteries in New Orleans, and I think it was there.
That's pretty cool.
They were pretty neat, yeah. But I think it was there, and there was this grave that had, like, plexiglass right on top of it, and air holes poked into it so that, A, if the person was dead, they could still breathe, obviously, but, B, that they could scream, and you would hear them. So just imagine that as well. Like, yeah, the bell's a great idea. But it's the middle of the night. It's a bell. Who's going to hear it? You know what's going to attract attention?
Screams.
Blood-curdling screams in the middle of the night from an open grave.
Oh, God.
Yeah. It's spooky stuff. Instead of dying shortly after he ran out of oxygen in his coffin, which happened to probably a lot of people over the years, it's fine, Clavius found his eternal rest disturbed. Now, instead of a rescue and a miraculous release, as I'm sure that he was kind of hoping for, it became apparent very quickly that the individual tearing Clavius from his final resting place was not there to help him. Now, Clavius had been beaten and bound. He was forced to drink a potion that restored his ability to move but put him in a dreamlike, hallucinogenic state. And from there, Clavius was transported to a sugarcane plantation where for 2 years he was worked from sunup to sundown, pausing only very shortly for a meal break in the middle of the day. Now, he noticed that he was not alone on the farm. He was unable to count the exact number of people, but he did remember seeing others like himself working mindlessly in the cane field. They were just regularly and mercilessly beaten and abused, in addition to being literal zombified slaves. And he and his compatriots were given regular injections of this hallucinogenic substance by the Bokor to keep them in this dreamlike state. So you can't really think, you can't really reason, you're extremely suggestible, and for the most part, it makes it so that you cannot fight back, which is, of course, crucial to all of this. It's only one man on the plantation. There's not him and a company of investors or anything like that. So you have to be able to keep him pretty well in check. However, eventually, there was a day when one of his fellow zombies was being beaten and he picked up a hoe and killed the sorcerer. And from there, they all escaped. But that happened only after 2 years of him being on the plantation.
So, well, then what was he doing for the next 16?
For the next 16 years. And it's just interesting. I don't know why, but I always just think Haiti's not that big of an island. He probably walked all over the place. He doesn't really say what he did, other than the fact that he did not go home. And the reason for that was that he felt like he knew why this had happened to him. He knew why he had been zombified. And like we said, while this is not a good thing, it's still a taboo in zombie or in voodoo culture. It is something that happens as a social check and balance.
Yeah, it's a punishment.
Mm-hmm. And the punishment came from Clairvius's brother. Now, in Haiti, it was obviously a byproduct of French colonization, and it uses French laws and some sorts and different French codes, one of which deals with the division of land after the death of the parents to the children, which states that instead of there being kind of like how we can do it here, where you can specifically say, like, this child gets this house and this child gets this.
Okay, a will.
Yeah.
There you go. That's what you're looking for.
So with that, in Haiti, it's part of the Napoleonic code or whatever, where it's all just cut up and dispersed evenly between the children, which means that Clairvius would have had to sell his part of the land and then disperse all of that. He refused to. He and his brother fought about this a lot. And finally, it ended up that Clairvius was breaking those social norms, and he was rebelling away against the way it had to be. And so his brother had essentially turned him over to a tribunal. Now, this all came out with more research. We're kind of jumping ahead in the actual development of it. But the end result is that Clairvius was turned over to a tribunal of a secret society. Now, that's the interesting thing about voodoo in Haiti as well, is that voodoo is so integral to the formation of Haiti. The actual beginning of the Haitian Revolution was a voodoo ceremony, and it's one that took place in secret with representative slaves from different plantations around the island. They all met in one place. They had a voodoo ceremony, and they drunk the blood of a pig and swore to kill the white men who had been oppressing them. Because of this, it is necessary that there are secret societies and that there are these different things running parallel to the normal world. So we mentioned it earlier that in the penal code of Haiti, it states that any zombification is treated like murder and this and that, but that's the official government code. In these secret societies that actually run things, it's the normal punishment for grievous crimes and things like this. According to the former president of Haiti, Michael Joseph Martelly, who was like a pop star, by the way.
What?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Like,
he was like the nation's most popular musician.
So he's like,
and then he became the president.
If David Hasselhoff was German,
right,
and then became
the chancellor, yes,
that
was Martelly.
That's
except
amazing.
I didn't really do too much reading. I think he then devolved into a despot. I'm not sure though. But yes, according to him, he says all Haitian elites are voodoo members, and they belong to Haitian secret societies. These secret societies, these are the ones who condemned Clairvius Narcisse. And it was said that they actually, in the typical narrative, he's sick for only 2 or 3 days and then he dies. In reality, he says that he had been sick for about a year before all of this happened. And he had been brought before a tribunal.
That's some slow poisoning right there.
Well, it was probably a fairly regular dosing by someone in the community. But he was brought before a tribunal, found guilty. They like cut him and then like made him soak his hands in some solution, some liquid. And that's where it all really, really started. because of this, when Angelina saw him in the market that day, while she was definitely happy to see him in her own little way, she basically just had to tell him, keep on walking, like, go on. You're a pariah. You're an outcast. And that's the other really compelling thing about this story, is that unlike really with any other hoax or anything else, you can always make the argument, regardless of how it turns out, if a person is hoaxing an alien abduction or a haunting or something like that, regardless how it usually turns out, where they're just shunned and they're penniless and they're poor, there can always be the motivation that, well, what if I do get rich from this and I get a book deal and I'm famous?
Right.
In Haitian culture, there is no possibility of that for a zombie. The zombie is always outcast and left to die alone after mm-hmm. time.
Which this is like, actually, I agree with you, Sam. I think this is a legitimate thing.
It's so interesting, man. It's so interesting. Now, Clairvius also made a statement at one point or the other. He said he was judged by the masters of the land who do as they please. He was outcast, and he stayed outcast for quite a while, until the story of Clairvius actually made its way to the, here we go again, guys, Centre de Psychiatrie et Neurologie, which I'm guessing means the Center of Psychiatry and Neurology.
Do you want to finish your words?
Well, that's how the French say it, right? They don't finish their words, so why should I?
Makes sense. They're drinking so much wine.
Hello, French listeners. I don't know if we have any of that. But now, the story makes its way there to the attention of one Dr. Lamarck Doyon, who was a Haitian-born and Canadian-trained psychiatrist who had been investigating any reports of zombies that he could get his hands on since 1961. What? He's like nodding his head. Yeah. What? Yeah?
Yeah.
You like this
guy? First off, great confidence with the pronunciation there.
Thank you.
Secondly, yeah, I like this dude.
You like this guy? the zombie hunter?
Well, it's not like the typical zombie hunter. He's zombie hunting on a neurological level.
Right. He's zombie hunting to understand, not to kill. Now,
we just want to understand, man. what do they want?
What are they here for?
Probably to re-enter society. Yeah. That's really what it is.
Well, Doyon was, he really did want to figure out more of the technical application. You know, how is this happening? What's used and all
Tell
that.
Me about these potions.
Yeah, the potions, the powders, all of that. In addition to, of course, studying the fascinating role it plays in society. But Doyon worked closely with Narcisse's family to create a test, one based extensively on the Narcisse family and events from Clairvius's childhood that no one, even a boyhood friend, would have been privy to. Now, the man claiming to be Clairvius answered every single question correctly, proving, as far as it can be proven, that the man who shambled into the market that day in 1980 was the same man who was buried in 1962. Now, in addition to this, two other pieces of evidence were put forward as to the veracity of Clairvius's claims, both uncovered by the BBC during their filming of a documentary shortly after Clairvius's story broke.
Did you actually watch that at all?
I could only find like a 4-minute clip.
Oh, and it was one of the... Was it from like straight out of the 80s?
Yeah.
That's probably why. It's tough to find.
Yeah, I couldn't find it anywhere. Oh, man, that's unfortunate. I looked. I think it's called like When Dead Men Walk, the story of Clairvius Narcisse. Nice. Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. But so
in British.
The whole thing's in British. You have to watch it subbed. You're not going to understand it anyway. Just like Troll Hunter.
Yes.
Now, the first is that over 200 individuals in the village of Lestrée, where Clairvius had lived in his whole life, confirmed that it was him. They said, yeah, that's Clairvius. Get this camera out of my face. The second one is that when Clairvius had died, another one of his sisters, Marie Claire, had been asked to identify the body. She did so, and she affixed her thumbprint to the death certificate in a way of verification, Marie Clary was still alive when her brother returned, and she had her fingerprints tested by Scotland Yard, who confirmed without a doubt that it had been her that day at the hospital declaring her brother's death. Because that's one of the theories here. That's one of the things that people say.
So Angelina wasn't there to...
Angelina was there. She stayed by him the entire time. But Marie Claire, who I think was the oldest sibling...
Okay, so she took she that responsibility.
In, yeah, to do it, especially with their parents being gone. So this is another one of the very common things that people say to debunk, is that this Albert Schweitzer Hospital, it had a different rate for locals and non-locals. So the idea is that a non-local would have come in, said, I'm Clavius Narcisse, just so that they didn't have to pay as much. And then, oh no, whoopsie daisy, they died. Yeah. And then for some other unknown reason, the actual Narcisse disappeared for 18 years and then came back into town. Or,
yeah, that's a great coincidence there.
Yeah. Or, of course, there's the other one, which is that Narcisse died and this guy's an imposter. Well, this guy's probably not an imposter because of all of those questions he answered. And because of Marie Claire, I mean, she's going to know what her brother looks like. That's just a stupid thing to say. That it's just dumb to even say, in my humble opinion. But she says, yes, this is him, and yes, he is dead. So
with that documentation and with it being validated as such, that's where our compelling evidence comes in. Yes. And our documentation comes in saying that this is something weird going on.
Yes. The other important thing that people point to is that the doctors, there were two doctors who affirmed his death. One of them was straight up American, and the other was Haitian born but American trained.
Yeah.
So, of course, the other connotation is, well, these people aren't properly trained. They can't truly diagnose death.
Well, but... I mean, unfortunately, that does have its merits, though.
Right.
Because Haiti used to be, while it was under French rule, was right. one of the...
Squalor.
It was, yeah. Now it's unfortunately become one of the poorest nations right. in the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, I guess. I just... That is so often pointed without people even double-checking the doctor... that it upsets me. Like, because it is very clearly documented that it was American-trained doctor and an American doctor. People yeah. don't even check that when they debunk this story. So,
oh, I think that's silly.
Yeah, it's silly. Duyon, in conjunction with his American partner, Dr. Nathan Klein, they came to the conclusion that Clavius was actually telling the truth of his poisoning and resurrection at the hand of the Bokor. And this is... the case, the one case that is actually documented with the actual death certificate, all of this, it's exactly what they needed in order to get people more serious about this. So they send this information back to the United States. They say, look at this. There is an actual case of an individual be putting in a coma-like state for days and then reanimated at will. This is groundbreaking stuff. And it also talks about, and I'm hoping because this book is written in like 1980, whatever, he talks about just how much guesswork goes into anesthesiology. And it really unsettles me.
It's really not a lot of guesswork anymore.
Okay, good.
Because that's what my brother is going to school for, essentially. Well, okay. He's pre-med now, but he's done his own research on it.
Right.
It's really just an assortment of very fun equations to work through.
Okay. Because he was indicating that it was a lot more dangerous than we all might want to think.
Well, everyone reacts to anesthetics differently.
Yeah.
So sometimes, like in surgery, you have to change the dosages.
Yeah.
So it is a little bit of on-the-fly work as well.
This is why they're excited about this. This could revolutionize medical science as well as anything and everything else. And so they send word back to the United States for assistance in order to figure out exactly what's going on here.
Did we talk about why Clavius actually came back, though? After the 18 years?
Oh, his brother died.
Yeah, we didn't get to that.
We
contained the story. So the reason why he took an 18-year hiatus from his family was because, well, now his brother that he had the dispute with finally keeled over and he caught wind of it and heard of it.
Nice. Thanks.
There we go.
Thanks.
And back to you, Sam.
So their request for assistance from the United States was answered by a 29-year-old doctoral student by the name of Wade Davis, who was an ethnobotanist.
You know, how refreshing is that name to say?
Wade Davis.
That's easy. That is it easy peasy. Nice. Lemon nice. Squeezy. I love it.
Now, Davis was informed of the opportunity through a professor who had sent him to the Amazon years earlier to search out new plants there. The same professor was a really cool dude who was like, you got to do two things in the Amazon, okay? One, you got to wear this special kind of helmet. It's going to stop you from getting poisoned by bees and stuff.
Oh, number that's two, good stuff there.
Number two, you got to drink this drug, bro. You got to drink the ayahuasca.
Yeah, from the documentary that I had seen with Wade, and he's rather fond of the psychedelics dude. That his mentor was very pro.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. So he met with Klein and one of Klein's associates, who placed the facts of the situation squarely in front of him. Now, again, at this time, he was not asked to get to the bottom of this in a general sense. Everyone involved, other than Davis at this point, believed that Clairvius was an actual real case of zombification. Instead, he was told to find out exactly what had gone into this poison. Now, Klein mentioned, like we did, that anesthesiology could be greatly improved with this substance, and he even mentioned a conversation he had had with NASA around the psychiatry of sending astronauts to other worlds.
Yeah, man, you gotta cryosleep someone, right?
Yeah, but it wouldn't be cryosleep, it would be zombie sleep. Zombie astronauts.
Sounds rejuvenating. There
it is. That's what it is. And the poison may be used to keep astronauts sane during months and months in interplanetary space.
Wait, which one? Is that the hallucinating one?
No, the sleepy one.
All right, the sleepy time one.
My bad. Okay. It's the hallucinogenic. Can you imagine being on mushrooms in space?
Yeah. Sounds amazing.
That would be the
But if something bad
experience.
Happens, I'm
oh,
screwed.
My gosh. Oh, no.
See, I don't know, man. I just assumed like it because it was like a dream-like state. You can't freak out and panic if you're in a dream-like state.
You want to bet? I freak out and panic in my dreams all the time.
Well, Sam, that's just your normal demeanor.
That's true. I'm a very scared person. All right, now then.
Back here on Earth.
Davis agrees and was sent on his way. He was given a plane ticket and a photo of Clairvius Narcisse and then departed for Haiti shortly after. Now, when Davis arrived in Haiti, he had been given two names by the documentary crew of the BBC in order to help him with his quest. The first was of Max Beauvoir, an intellectual and authority in the voodoo religion, and the second was Marcel Pierre, who was the voodoo priest who had provided the BBC with a sample of the so-called zombie poison. He had been described as the incarnation of evil by those who had worked with him.
Dang.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. Now, almost immediately after his arrival, he went to see Max Beauvoir. Beauvoir was born in 1936, and he recently passed away in 2015, but he was an ordained voodoo priest. By the time he died, he had risen to the closest thing, or he had risen to be the closest thing of a unified spiritual leader that voodoo had. He had held the title of Supreme Servitor, or Supreme Servant, which denoted his deep understanding of the faith and his defense of it against the Christian authorities of outside sources attempting to wash voodoo away. Now, the interesting thing about Beauvoir is that he was actually trained as a biochemist at the University of Paris in New York. He worked as a chemical engineer and came back to Haiti in 1973, prompted by the death of his father.
Mm-hmm.
He was then told by his grandfather that he was going to carry on the voodoo tradition. That was it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And he said, well, that's not really something you say no to. And so the next year, he founded a voodoo temple in his home. And it was here in this temple that Wade Davis met with him in 1982. Upon his arrival, Beauvoir explained to Davis that if he was searching for a poison, he would be doing so for quite a long time, because he claimed it is the man, the Bokor, who creates the zombie, not the poison. Now, he declined to put Davis on the trail of anyone who might be able to make this zombie poison, but instead invited him back to witness a voodoo ceremony that night. In order to provide a better framework for his work, Davis agreed, and we're going to take a brief break here to do our best to explain voodoo to you all as well. But first, we are going to have a brief break for our sponsors. You can ask anyone. The difference between an amateur and a professional is in the production of the product. Whether it's film, radio, podcast, blog, or any other creative outlet, good stock media is worth its weight in gold. And this holiday season is the best time to up your game. Right now, by going to videoblocks.com/notalone, you will get a year-long subscription to the biggest and best stock media libraries out there for just $149. We're talking audio tracks, video clips, and stock images, all for one low, low price included in the special holiday bundle, all royalty-free forever. Now, this offer is only good through December, so you make sure you head over to videoblocks.com/notalone for the price that you would usually pay to get access to just the stock video library. You'll get access to all of Storyblocks' media libraries, sourced from independent content creators. And the creators are getting paid as well, so you can feel good about using this service. It's a win-win-win. If you're ready to take your passion project and turn it into something that can compete with the endless stream of everyone else's passion projects, head over right now to videoblocks.com/notalone. That's videoblocks.com/notalone. You'll be glad you did. Friends, I have news for you. The holidays are no longer right around the corner. Instead, the holidays are upon us. During this last-minute smash and grab, it can be so difficult to find a gift for others that feels authentic, real, and not just something that you threw in the basket with the customary, well, I guess that'll do. Well, now I have some good news for you. Our friends over at songfinch.com have the perfect solution, and they have it for you in time for the holidays. Working with a community of over 250 professional musicians, they will craft you a meaningful, personalized song for any occasions. Anniversaries, birthdays, graduations, holidays, just because, and of course, any other life event worth mentioning, can all be immortalized through song. The song itself will be written to your specifications, including the genre, the mood, and what stories, memories, or feelings you want to convey through the song. From there, your songwriter does the rest. Songs are built from scratch and delivered within 7 days. That means if by the time you finish listening to this advertisement, you go to songfinch.com, they will have this ready for the holidays. And right now, for being a listener of Not Alone, Songfinch is offering you the chance to save $20 by using the offer code NOTALONE at checkout. That's NOTALONE at checkout to save $20 off the most memorable gift anyone could ever receive. Again, that's songfinch.com and coupon code NOTALONE at checkout.
One thing I would absolutely like to say is that it tends to be a reoccurring thing that if something drives you or says that, you know, you need to be a part of voodoo culture in some aspects, because I also watched a brief documentary that National Geographic published about a African girl. So this was back in West Africa again, where her dad was essentially like a tribal town leader, and he wanted her to have a formal education. Mm-hmm. Well, turns out that she was essentially chosen as to be a voodoo oracle. And because her father did not want that and kept her in school, she started having learning issues. Like, she wasn't actually able to hear the teachers when she was being spoken to and things like that. And then they finally succumbed to her actually becoming a voodoo priestess almost.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
So it's once you get chosen for to be a bigger role in voodoo culture, there's no navigating away from it.
Wow. Interesting. That is interesting. And there is also a lot more to voodoo than zombies and dolls. So the religion itself is one that goes back a long, long time, like Jason said, originating in Africa, which found its way west on slave ships. Now, voodoo, like most religions, is one of balance. during Max Beauvoir's conversation with Wade Davis, an attempt to explain what the Bokor is to him, Beauvoir stated that the Bokor is a priest who serves with the left hand, which is a common terminology when it comes to magic. You have your right-hand path and you have your left-hand path. And your right-hand path is using magic for good, and its left hand is using it for bad.
That's why I'm a lefty. This makes sense.
Are you left-handed?
I am.
I am left-handed as well. How did we not know this entire time?
How did you not know this about me?
Did you know that about me?
Yeah, dude.
Look
what side of your body your cup and your phone are on.
Damn.
You're just not very observant.
I'm not. I would not be the Sherlock Holmes of this story.
Gosh.
Oh, no. Anyway, so he says a Bokor is a priest who serves with the left hand, but that is a false distinction. In a way, we are all Bokor, we Hungen, and the Hungen is the priest, the traditional priest. The Hungen must know evil to combat it, and the Bokor must embrace good in order to subvert it. It is all one.
The force.
It's, but
there's
the force,
the duality.
Yeah, the force is just your typical dualism.
It's the yin and
of
yang.
Life. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I really like that statement he says, though, because you often hear, like, about, like, demon hunters and stuff. Well, we have to be close to evil, Dean, because we gotta fight it. Okay, Sam, whatever. But you don't really think about the other side of it, where the evil has to know the good in order to do the opposite of good, right? It's very interesting. I like that a lot. But voodooists, which is how practitioners are known, they believe in a supreme creator called Bandai, which comes from the French word, or French words, bon Dieu, which means good God. Now, Bandai created the universe and everything in it, but he's above it. He doesn't interact with it. It's beneath him to interact with humankind, and therefore he is completely unknowable. So instead, the voodooists direct their worship towards the spirits, which are called the Loa, who are known to intercede on the behalf of humanity. The Loa are numerous and named, unlike the typical spirits of spiritualism, wherein you just say, oh, I feel the spirits. Really, typical spiritualism these days especially has, like, Archangel Michael. And that's like it. And everything else is just nameless, faceless. Now, the Loa are numerous and named. They have their own attributes, their own character traits. And unlike other Judeo-Christian religions, the Loa are served and worshipped, which, in a false equivalency to Christian angels, is a big no-no. There are whole books of the Bible about how you don't serve the angels. But in voodoo, you do serve the Loa. And the Loa are invoked by the voodoo ceremonies. Voodooists share an extremely intimate relationship with the spirits, calling upon them daily to navigate through life. Now, during the voodoo ritual, the Loa are called down by the Hungen, which, like I said, is the traditional priest, and the Mambo, which is the traditional priestess, in order to directly interact with the practitioners. The Loa then mount or possess the ritualists participating in the ceremony. This can either be a violent occurrence, including a lot of flailing and shaking and wailing, or it can be a quiet and calm one, because again, all of these Loas have their own distinct personalities, their own attributes and way of doing things. They have their own signs and symbols as well, specific clothes or food or drink that are associated with them, and then provided to them as an offering once they arrive. Now, the Loa come from different families and behave differently. Some are ancient, from times far back in Africa, and are much more dignified. They're spirits, and that's all they've ever been, elemental spirits or other things like that. Other ones, like the Geti, are the spirits of the dead. And this family is headed by Papa Geti, which is the corpse of the first man who ever died. And he slips into that traditional function that I love so much, which is that of a psychopomp, taking people from the living world into the world of the dead.
Where did that word come from?
Psychopomp?
Yeah.
I don't know the origin of it.
Really? Where did you first read of it?
Probably
because for every time I hear it, I think of, like, steampunk. It's like, I think the psychopomp is steampunk, is what I the connection I made.
I think I probably first heard it on Mysterious Universe, which is a paranormal podcast I listen to. And they were probably talking about a different spirit or something in relation to Chiron of the River Styx.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
He's the archetypal in Western culture, the archetypal psychopomp, because he does a physical...
Yeah, Shepherd of Souls.
Yeah, physical movement. But it's just my favorite. I love the concept of it. I love the word itself. It's...
I know, because it's awesome. You use it frequently.
I know. We've been doing this for like 43 episodes. I try to work it in whenever I can. So Papa Getty, he's a psychopomp. Other Loa are associated with aspects of Roman Catholicism. Individuals like Michael the Archangel and John the Baptist are treated as Loa. And in other examples, they are, and I know I've said this word a lot, trying to prepare for this, I still can't say it. In other examples, they are syncretized.
Thank God, because I stumbled over that
too. It's syncretized. So it's not like synchronized or anything like that. It's syncretized.
Syncretized.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's weird.
Yeah.
It's a weird one.
Anyway, they're syncretized with Roman Catholic states, saints. Now, what that means with syncretization is the combining of different aspects of religion.
Yeah, it's a melting pot of different beliefs because of the culture.
Yes, the blending of schools of thought. Yes. For example, the most famous Loa, especially to the uninitiated in voodoo, is most likely Baron Samedi, which most of you will probably have seen depictions of. He's depicted as wearing a top hat, black glasses, a long black coat with tails. His face is painted to appear like a skull. He's kind of the poster boy for voodoo, essentially, especially in America. He is the patron of death, graves, smoking, drinking, and disruption. He's pretty great.
Yeah.
And he's
here for a good time, not a long time.
Yeah, exactly. That is exactly what it is. He is syncretized with Saint Martin de Porres. I don't know exactly how.
Martin's not a saint then.
Well, I don't, because all of them are. All of the Loa share with a Catholic saint. I don't know how they choose which one is which and why and this and that.
There has to be a lot of Catholic saints then.
There are a lot of Catholic saints. And there are a lot of Loa.
Because, yeah, like, you provoke voodoo to help you with any kind of real issue that you're having in your life. And there's different Loas for each one. Mm-hmm. So if it's financial, if it's health, anything throughout your day that you're having an issue with, that's when you bring voodoo into the ties. So that's a lot of different spirits.
How many Catholic saints are there?
400,000.
Some estimates have the number exceeding 10,000.
Okay, that'll work. Yeah. That'll do.
There are a lot of Catholic saints, and there are a lot of Loa.
Okay.
There might even be more saints than there are Loa. So they all share, and I don't know exactly how or why. I tried to look more into it, but I feel like it's something you probably need to do a lot of study to understand behind. But one of the interesting ones...
It's got to be the heavy French influence.
Well,
it's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah. It just comes from the fact that when slaves were taken, they were given 7 days to convert to Catholicism.
Bummer.
Yeah. So they converted.
Yeah.
And then, right, they converted in name and in word, but not in actuality. They continued doing their worship
in secret. Yeah. And that's
voodoo spirits, you know, in secret. And also, over time, it did become an amalgamation of Roman Catholicism and voodoo at the same time. That's why voodoo, Haitian voodoo, is different from Ghanaian voodoo. And all they're different sects. Just like in Christianity, you have Roman Catholicism and you have Protestantism, but the Protestants have 10,000 different sects as well, you know, mm-hmm. and the Catholics as well have a few. So... one of the interesting ones, though, with this equivalating with a saint is actually Baron Samedi's wife, who is an individual known as Mama Bridget. Now, she is synchronized or syncretized with Saint Brigid, who herself is a syncretization of the triple goddess Brigid that we touched on in our Charlie Walton episode. So it's like boom, 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 three layers. It's insane.
She's doing a lot of work.
She's all over the place.
Yeah. She's a busy lady.
Now, basically, in its purest sense, the veneration of supernatural beings and the act of prayer and offering to them in an effort to get them to intercede on your behalf with the highest power in the universe, this is the same idea that the Catholic, not worship, but the Catholic praying to saints is. They share this very closely, and I think that that's why it blended so well. It's the same sort of concept at its core. Now, at the end of the ceremony, the Loa will depart from their horse, which is what the practitioner is referred to. And some go easy, some do not. This is where the Hungan and the Mambo come in. They're responsible for the welfare of the practitioners, as well as making sure that the Loa are respected and satisfied. And they shepherd these Loa back into the land of the dead when their time has come. It's interesting because some of them have, like I said, they have their own personality. Some spirits go easy. Other ones, like the Gettys, which Baron Samdi, Papa Getty, all of the kind of party spirits are a part of, when they're told, you know, it's time to leave, their mouths will say, yeah, well, I'll leave after one more drink. I'll leave after another cigarette. I'll leave after this and that. And it's also just so specific. For instance, Papa Getty, he requires an offering of a cigar and whiskey, but it has to be a cheap cigar and cheap whiskey. He doesn't like the good stuff. It's just
it's great.
It's just so interesting. It's crazy. But it is this sort of a ceremony that Wade Davis viewed that night. Now, the ceremony itself is something, well, before I get into that, do you have anything you want to say about voodoo?
No, man, I think we covered it really well. Okay. Yeah.
The ceremony described by Davis is something that is seriously, it evokes wonder to even just read about it. He is, in addition to being a great researcher, a great scientist, he's also a great writer. And you should just buy this book. That's what we're saying here. Now, Davis notes the way that the Loa are summoned. And he talks about the different drum beats and rhythms and dances that are used by the practitioners. He notes that the drum beats in the first ceremony crescendoed for 40 minutes. They started out very soft and then built and built for 40 straight minutes. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, the rhythm is just destroyed by the main drummer. And he said that it fractured your, like, internal being a little bit. It broke you a little bit, and it's like it emptied you out when it happened. And then when you are emptied from there, that's when the Loa mount and the Loa come in. So out of nowhere, when this happens, one of the women, they're called the Husinis, I think, the Husinis. They're the temple initiates, essentially. One of them, she becomes something else entirely. According to voodoo beliefs, when the individual is mounted by the Loa, they are no longer human. The woman certainly acted this way. Davis witnessed her biting glass, swallowing portions of it, and spitting out the rest.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
You're not going to survive that.
I was so excited for this part with Jason.
Oh, God.
Just.
She swallowed a shard of glass?
She swallowed multiple shards of glass.
No.
And more impressively.
Could you think of.
More. Well, we'll down, get into down, this. We'll get into
throat
this.
Throat to the stomach. Oh, intestine. Oh.
Now, after this, and this entire time, she's just running around screaming, basically.
Yeah, she just ate glass.
No. Even before that. Now, a dove was offered to the Loa as a sacrifice, and it was promptly ripped apart by the woman.
That's fair.
Davis marveled at the way that she took hold of men twice her size and threw them around like rag dolls. Now, during all of this, the Mambo rushed around the scene, spraying rum and water all over the place, and directed the Loa with her ceremonial rattle known as the Asan. Now, after a time, the mount suddenly collapsed. The Loa departed as suddenly as they had appeared, but this was only the first of multiple mountings that Davis had witnessed that night, and he learned the differences between the families of Loa and what they signified. The first possession was performed by members of the Rada family, and the Rada are the ancestral spirits hailing from the voodoo practices of the old world, particularly in the now defunct kingdom of Dahomey in West Africa, which is now known as the Republic of Benin after being colonized by the French. Now, the kings of Dahomey would sell the captives that they captured in war as slaves, and its capital was originally developed to be a major slave port. Now, the Rada remain the safe keepers of ancient morals. The next ceremony was to invoke the spirits of the Petro family. Now, these are newer spirits that were created by the cruelty of slavery, and the drum beats used to summon members of this family mimic the cracking of whips, and gunpowder is used as well. These spirits are angry and are violent, and they exemplify the rage and power that struck the shackles of slavery from the people of Haiti. The senior spirit of the Petro family is Azili Dantor. She is extremely powerful, and it was she who was invoked all the way back in 1791 at the very beginning of the slave revolt. Like we had mentioned, there was a place known as Bois Cayman. Representative slaves from nearby plantations gathered to participate in a secret ceremony. When Dantor was invoked, she was sacrificed to with a black Creole pig. She accepted the sacrifice of the pig as well as the pledges of all who were there to fight for the freedom of the people of Haiti. And she was said to grant them the power to win this revolution. And in doing so, they became the only slave revolt to have ever ended in the establishment of a new nation. And that new nation was, of course, the first independent Black People's Republic in the history of the world. It is impressive stuff. This idea of voodoo being the demon's religion and this and that, it comes from this. It comes from the fact that the slave masters were white Christians, and they were beat by what they saw as black savages who could have only gotten power through the devil himself to beat all of these good, God-fearing men. And so, I mean, that's where this comes from all the way back then. In fact, in 2010... when there was that big earthquake down there was this televangelist.
Oh my gosh, that was 7 years ago.
I know, right? It's crazy. Man. There was this televangelist by the name of Pat Robertson who said on TV that the reason this happened was because the whole country was found off a deal with the devil and they're all demon worshipers, and so they deserve to have an earthquake because that guy's just a real piece of you know what.
Cool, bro.
Yeah.
Cool. So, thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Appreciate that.
And then unfortunately, between that and then there was right after that an outbreak of cholera because of like these statements and people saying that, people in Haiti got spooked and the non-voodoo practitioners ended up lynching voodoo practitioners because they were being told it was their fault. So, I don't know. Maybe be a little more careful with your words, people. Anyway, now, as the spirits of this family, this angry, fiery family, entered the ceremony, it was done so with the fire and grit of the men and women who fought in that rebellion hundreds of years previous. The practitioner who found herself mounted almost immediately jumped into the fire and stood there for what Davis described as an impossibly long time. After that, she jumped out and she proceeded to lick flaming sticks and to eat hot coals. The coal was in her mouth for like 3 minutes, and then she spat it out and Davis like tried to grab it. It was still hot at that point. Now, in time, she, like the previous spirits, was emptied and returned back to the world of the living. Davis credits this witnessing of the ceremony as a big part of his understanding that voodoo was not just folklore. It was not just white society being scared of what it does not understand. There had to be some sort of raw power to this, and more likely than not, one of such extreme belief that it allows its practitioners to eat hot coals every night. That's the thing. I know that your scientific mind is saying, well, she probably then had to go to the hospital. She had showed up the night before and done this, and she showed up the night after and did this.
No, my mind's jumping to, oh, it's the same trick with walking on coals. It's fire walking. It's the same kind of idea.
Oh, it could be, yeah. But anyway, it allows its practitioners to eat hot coals every night without suffering harm. This really, I mean, more than the pharmacological, more than the mental and all of that, the physical, this spiritual aspect of it, with him being an ethnobotanist, a mix between an anthropologist and a botanist, this really compelled him to move forward. And that, his journey trying to find the voodoo poison, the zombie poison, understanding how these things are possible, that is going to be our subject of next week's episode.
What? You're going to leave it right
We're
here?
We're going to leave it right there at the end of the ceremony.
Dude, you're the worst.
I know, I am. But so what's your initial reaction? What are you thinking?
A lot of it has to deal with the psychosocial aspect of the belief system.
Yeah.
And how they're raised believing in voodoo so heavily. It's such a huge part
it
of their culture.
It creates their reality.
Exactly. So, and as far as the whole coal eating aspect, actually, that was a part of the documentary I watched as well. A man actually just straight up ate a piece of wood that was on fire, and that's terrifying, but he just chomped at it.
Mm-hmm.
But what I noticed is that when he was eating it, his saliva was actually running out of his mouth pretty quickly, and it was just like pure black. So my initial thoughts was that it's a lot to do with kind of like, again, firewalking, to where you use essentially water on the bottom of your feet in order mm-hmm. to essentially counteract the heat transfer from coals, because
right.
I believe it's water has a high heat something. I think I've still got the link up on my Safari page real quick. So yes, water has a very high specific heat capacity, whereas the embers have a low specific capacity. So that allows for essentially in my understanding, that the water can absorb heat better than what the coals can put off of it. Now, I could be just completely wrong there.
No.
But yeah. Essentially, the water is a buffer.
Yeah.
So the saliva could be essentially the same sort of buffer enacting on it. And obviously, when you have anything in your mouth, your body instantly produces more saliva.
Right. Davis mentions this.
Something like that?
Yeah. In fact, he says he also doesn't necessarily buy that on the walking on coals. He says that generally, in order to explain these feats, scientists invoke what is known as the Leidenfrost point, citing the effect that makes the drops of water dance on a skillet. You know, when you, and it goes tss. This theory suggests that just as heat vaporizes the bottom of the water droplet as it approaches the skillet, a thin layer of protective vapor is formed between the burning rocks, for example, and the firewalker's feet. I had to smile as I recalled this explanation. To my mind, it begged the question entirely. After all, a water droplet on a skillet is not a foot on a red-hot coal, nor lips wrapped around an ember. I still burn my wet tongue if I place the lit end of a cigarette on it. And my own experience in Indian sweat lodges, where the temperatures may reach the boiling point, has taught me that only concentration and the guidance of the medicine man allowed one to endure such a test. So while he, of course, does not ascribe a supernatural idea to it, he, you know, he doesn't say it's magic, he does think that it is more of the mind overpowering the body than anything else.
That's so, fair. Yeah, and I honestly, I just don't think we have. That's the problem with doing research on firewalking and coal eating, is that it doesn't get a lot of funding.
No, it
that's,
doesn't.
That's the big issue.
It doesn't.
Is that it's not a big thing we need to research. Mm-hmm. It's not high on the list of priorities.
Well, it's just indicative of the difference between Western culture and Eastern culture. Western culture is so materialistic, and so how can this help me make money? How can this help me advance my station? Whereas Eastern is more of how can this make me a better person? How can this like apply to my mental fortitude more? You know, so yeah, it doesn't get a lot of funding. It should though. So anyway, That's a good intro. That's a good start. It is full of stuff that's just unbelievable to me. But one of the things is that I check this out multiple times. While people disagree with Wade's premises and Wade's conclusions, and sometimes even the way he goes about doing things, nobody is calling him a liar. And his studies here in Haiti led to him actually getting his doctoral degree. He wrote his thesis on this. He defended that thesis to the point where he became a doctor of ethnobotany. Like, this is not fake, right? This is not just a fanciful story like the Magic Island of Seaward might be, or something like that. So it's full of interesting stuff. We're going to get more into Davis's discoveries and journey next week as we try to uncover exactly what happened to Clavius.
And you leave us here.
And I leave us here. Yeah, but it's good. It's a good time. It's a good story. We're going to get further on it next week. But yeah, that's where we end now. So what do you say?
Wanting more.
Wanting more.
That's how I feel.
Good. Well, good. I hope you all feel the same way. And we'll be back next week with part two. And then after that, I think we're going to do that interview with Rob. And then it's going to be Christmas. Merry Christmas. And then in the new year, either right off the bat or after a week, we're going to do one of my favorite UFO stories of all time, which will be fun. But yeah, cool.
What else do we got to cover?
Do you want to make a very special announcement?
What was my special announcement?
About social media?
No, it's scaring me already.
I'll make the very special announcement.
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
Jason officially has a Twitter, and we are teaching him how to use the Twitters.
I'm so scared. I don't like it already.
So his username is at Mighty Moit. That's MIGHTYMOIT. So go harass Jason.
Oh dear.
We are at Not Alone Podcast. That's or Not Alone Pod. That's me. So
that makes more sense.
Yeah.
Harass that one.
Harass that guy. So yeah, it's a good time. Go follow him. He doesn't know how to use Twitter. So
there's a really good chance I won't know how to reply back to you.
That's okay. I'm gonna teach him. Now, in other news, we got multiple different ratings this week. We got 3 or 4 or 5 star ratings, which we appreciate. We only got one actual review written out.
Ooh.
And it is by JamesStyle12. So he says, check it out. Love this podcast. Definitely worth checking out if you're interested in the paranormal. So thank you, James. Short, sweet, to the point. I love it. And then beyond that, make sure you check out. You go to videoblocks.com/notalone to claim your exclusive offer through them. Help make your stuff look good and sound good and seem good.
And that's all that really matters.
That's all that – it doesn't actually have to be good. That's what we've learned through the years.
Oh,
It doesn't have to be good. It just has to seem good. So, yes, go support them.
That's taking skills.
That's a great way of supporting the podcast. Leaving a 5-star review on iTunes, that's another great way. And, of course, donating to our Patreon, that's another great way. So, and if you can't do any of that, that's okay. We still love you. We think you're great. Make sure you go back, check out Zang This. This week's episode of that. Yeah. Other than that, who did it last week?
Well, you did it during Troll Hunter.
I did it
Hunter,
on Troll Hunter.
Which means I technically did it last week.
But I did it last.
So what do we
last.
Do? Yeah. This is
if
a conundrum.
If you want to hear my version of it, go listen to Zang This. I do it at the end. We're going to just keep with the cycle. We're going to pass it back to Jason. It's your turn.
Ooh, okay. Remember, whether you're hunting for the secret ingredients in a zombie powder or finding yourself zombified in a cane field, you are not alone.